it's not even a domestic group, it's an international, it's a global thing, you know, with migration of borders and it's so incredibly real, people dying because of the pandemic, that it's just, I worry a lot and I think a lot about how we are going to be as people.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen, an attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm so delighted with today's guest. And as usual, she will introduce herself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sangha Jong. I'm the CEO of Empowered. Empowered is a B Corp that has been in existence for 9 years. And we have a very interesting business model. We produce and distribute portable solar lighting products all around the world. But in developed marketplaces, we sell to those who use our products for recreational uses, for camping, hiking, and other adventures. The real purpose of our company, though, is to also address the real world need for electricity all around the world. There are 3 billion people around the world who have intermittent access to electricity. So because of the way that our business has been created, we're able to tier our margin structures and sell to those in emerging markets, either directly or through NGO partners, so that our prices are affordable, our products are the highest quality, and individuals all around the world can use our products in lieu of harmful kerosene or firewood to be able to engage in everyday activities such as cooking, learning, keeping their businesses open. So we're really proud of everything that we've created. My founder, John Salzinger, started with the company 9 years ago. And to date, we've affected over 4 million lives and averted 2.5 million tons of carbon dioxide.
Wow. Yeah, that's so great. And how did you get involved then with the company?
So my background is a little bit different. I was actually born into some humble circumstances, and I used a kerosene lamp when I was young. We didn't have running water or electricity in our home. And then eventually I immigrated to the US. We were still very poor at the time, and I had to teach myself how to read by looking at consumer products, actually, you know, cereal boxes, shampoo bottles. And so fast forward many years, I went to school thinking that I would learn more about sustainability. And my goal was to work for an organization like the UN or the World Bank to help improve the lives of those who had grown up in circumstances such as myself. But even as I was going through school, I wasn't sure how to actually affect this change. So I decided to go into the world of business, and I went into consumer products. And that's why I mentioned that's actually how I learned to read. And I really enjoyed the entire world of consumer products, creating product, marketing, selling products to meet, you know, the everyday needs of consumers. And then, you know, many decades passed, and I still wondered, you know, how am I going to actually go back to what I originally wanted to do, which was affect, you know, more substantial change in the lives of those who might have been born into different circumstances. I love the world of business, but I just didn't know how to make that pivot. And I thought maybe when I retire, I'll do something good for the world. And Empowered actually found me while I was at a different company that I had helped to co-found. Mm-hmm. And I read about the company and I was astounded that a company like this could exist, that, you know, was making products for people to enjoy, you know, every day recreationally, but that was also having this substantial impact on those around the world. So that's how I joined the company, you know, close to 5 years ago. And again, I mentioned earlier, my business partner, John Salzinger, you know, from day one, he's been such an inspiration to work with. Mm. The model of the company was, you know, his idea. And it's been, you know, an incredible journey to be able to affect this change that as a young person, mm-hmm. and then as someone going through school, you know, that I really wanted to do, but I did not know that business could play such a role that it's able to play. Mm-hmm. And we are B Corp, we're a benefit corporation, and you know, the world has changed substantially so that there are more companies like us that are not only focused on profit, but also on helping the environment and helping others.
That's so awesome. And I forgot to congratulate you. I mean, you were just, I think this month, because this month is Women's History Month, you were mentioned as one of the 100 leaders by the Real Leader. It's a digital and print magazine, right? As the 100 women leaders that you should know. So that's pretty impressive within 5 years. So
thank you.
Congratulations with that. Yeah.
Thank you. No, it was a real honor. And sometimes it's hard to imagine, again, you know, how humbly I grew up and not even having access to education, to basic mm-hmm. means. I'm very thankful that my parents immigrated and that the opportunities, you know, in the U.S. were so plentiful. But every day I do imagine, you know, what my life could have been and the lives of those that we actually affect through our products. And we have many incredible stories of young people who have literally used our lights to be able to study at night and then who have progressed in their education, even during the short time that, you know, we've been in existence. The stories are really powerful, especially when you hear about someone, you know, going to college for the first time, or, you know, being able to, you know, pursue their dreams. And those are the stories that are so momentous. You know, I spoke about our statistics, but when we receive an individual letter or a photo from someone whose life we've affected, that's so incredibly meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And What I also like about your company is you work a lot in partnership, right? And
yes.
When you go to your website, you see also all the, you know, an enormous list of partners and also NGOs like that you work with. So can you explain a little bit then how it works, these partnerships?
Yes. So we do have over 500 NGO partners that we mm-hmm. work with. I'll name just one of them. Because recently they shared through their social media an mm-hmm. accomplishment we had worked on together, and that's Save the Children. Mm-hmm. So we donated over 6,000 lights for their various efforts around the world. And again, you know, I've mentioned the use of our lights in education settings, but also in health settings. Our lights have been very important. So mm-hmm. Whether it's immunization clinics or birthing clinics, there's just a lot, you know, that we're able to provide around health, safety, education, female entrepreneurship. And so with our NGO partners, each of whom, you know, does incredible work in either a very local localized setting or globally, we're able to amplify our effort. We know that our NGO partners do what they do best and can get our lights to those who need them. Mm-hmm. And the way we're able to work with them, if it's a straight donation, is that somewhere, whether it's our consumers or whether there's a corporation that has partnered with us, they are defraying the costs or absorbing the costs of the products themselves so that the NGOs can distribute. Otherwise, we do also work in strong partnerships with the likes of Amazon, for instance. So, you know, we sell on Amazon, but also Amazon has a section called Disaster Relief, whereby they have worked in, I think, over 23 different natural disaster situations around the world. Mm-hmm. And they deploy our lights in those situations because we're one of their brands. They keep a stockpile of our products that they, you know, purchase from us. And then when there's a natural disaster, they deploy our lights. Mm-hmm. So it's through both these corporate partnerships as well as the NGO partnerships that, whether in development situations or in natural disaster situations, we are able to deploy our lights to those who need them. Mm-hmm. Without having, you know, our own massive infrastructure, we don't have offices in other countries. We're not reliant upon these communities for our own existence. Mm-hmm. That's why we have this blended business model where we rely upon, you know, the consumer in Australia, in France, in the US, you know, who purchases our products at any number of, you know, major outdoor sporting goods retailers. And through their purchase, we're then able to do all of this work with all of our partners. And absolutely, we could not do this work without our partners. Hmm.
Great. I'm so impressed with what you do and how you do it. And I know, you know, my organization is also talking with you. So I hope, you know, that partnership will develop. So I would like to take you to another, you know, area. But you know that now for 9 years, I've walked 100 miles to try to raise awareness about hunger and poverty and injustice. You know, I walked at 100 mile in 1 week, so 15 to 20 miles a day. I walk with other people, you know, we talk about all kinds of topics while I'm walking. And this particular podcast is a kind of a spin-off of that. So I would like to know from you, you know, if you would be asked to walk 100 mile in a week, for which cause would you then walk? Or actually run, because I know you're a runner, so... Yeah.
Yes. So I am a runner. I try to run a marathon in a different country every year. And I actually started that practice when my daughter was in the hospital. She was born with a congenital heart defect and had open heart surgery on her third day of life. And I needed to find a way to be able to handle my emotions. And in fact, that's actually when I started walking and then running. So your question is a very real question that I have actually incorporated into my everyday life. Mm-hmm. So that was over 8 years ago. And it did start out with walking because I didn't have the conditioning to be able to run. And I remember saying, okay, if you can get to that tree, if you can get around that corner. And I just kept driving myself thinking that I needed patience. I needed mindfulness. There were a lot of things that this running walking combination did for me during this critical time. So my answer is that I would walk for health. I think there's so many things that are important in one's life, but without health and physical well-being, so much else is not possible. And so I continue to walk or run, not only for my own health. I had COVID last year and I was hit very hard with COVID. And it was just another reminder of how important health can be. And it took me almost a year, I would say like 9 months, to be able to recover my respiratory health to the point where I could start running again. And right now I have my sights on a marathon in Portugal in October. Wow. And so for me, it's not only, you know, my own health, but it's the health of those around me. Mm-hmm. And when I think too about the work that I do, that is also really important to me. You know, mm-hmm. I mentioned I grew up with kerosene lamps. They're notoriously very bad for respiratory health. Mm-hmm. So when I think about safety and health, and that comes in many forms, right? Your environment, yeah. your, you know, having access to medicine and to medical practices. I think that it's so fundamentally important, and to be able to equalize access to healthcare. You know, my parents had to immigrate back to Korea because they didn't qualify for healthcare and it was so expensive. Mm. And that was just something that sort of broke apart our family at one point. And thankfully now they're back in the US, but access to healthcare, because they are now of age where they qualify for Medicare, et cetera. But healthcare to me is such a fundamental right, I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I would walk for, you know, both to bring awareness to health through mm-hmm. the practice of walking, but also, you know, how important it is in all of our lives.
If you don't mind me asking, your daughter fully recovered? She's doing fine?
She's fully recovered, thank you. She's doing fine. She's a wonderful little girl, just full of joy. But I still continue the practice. I said to mm-hmm. her when she was very young that, mm-hmm. you know, my goal is to live to 100 and to show and to have her live to 100. Mm-hmm. And part of it is taking care of ourselves, you know, having that, mm-hmm. you know, focus on physical activity. And walking is wonderful, not only for your physical health, but also your mental health. Mm-hmm. So it's the perfect thing that, you know, perfect kind of question, because I feel like it's, mm-hmm. Really all-inclusive, you know, health and walking and well-being.
Well, you know, maybe you can join me this coming year for my walk. So I would like to ask you also, what drives you in life? You know, when you wake up in the morning and, you know, what do you think and where do you go for?
So what drives me is actually, this may sound like a strange answer, but pleasure. It's really combined with the idea of gratitude. So when my feet touch the ground in the morning, I try to be very aware, you know, if the sun is shining or even if it's raining, like I'm aware that it's a new day, that there are things to appreciate. I'm grateful that my feet have touched the ground and I'm able to stand and enjoy another day and think about the opportunities and the challenges of that day in a grateful way. And I do think that creating pleasure, not only for yourself, but for others. And I use that word specifically because I think that it's more than just doing what you feel like you need to do or get done. It's not just ticking things off of a to-do list. Mm-hmm. It's finding enjoyment, finding fulfillment. You know, it's a broader sense of mm-hmm. what your day is about, the people you encounter, the work that you do, the food that you eat, the nature that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I think if you approach it in a certain way, all of that can bring you pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I think about motivation, that it's not to achieve something. It's not that end goal, but it's really being present mm-hmm. in, you know, your choices and what you're able to do, and to enjoy what you're doing and to be grateful.
Beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. You know, when I walk with you know, my guests, we often also start talking about, and we talk about, you know, what drives you, also about religion and spirituality. And, you know, I guess walking also has to do with pilgrimage and you know, meditative states and you know, wonder. And then also often we end up talking about the younger generation and if they are experiencing it differently or similarly. I would like to ask you, you know, what are your thoughts? What do you see with the younger generation around religion and spirituality? What do you see happening in your community? And are they less or you know, more religious and spiritual than the older generation? Yeah, do you have some thoughts about that? And you would like to share that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, and I don't know where I fall in terms of mm-hmm. age. I did grow up in a deeply religious household. My mm-hmm. father was actually a Christian minister. Mm-hmm. I was very engaged in religion at an early age, but I will say that at one point I dissociated myself from the church and probably veered more towards some form of spirituality. Mm-hmm. I think from my perspective with the younger generation, and I do have friends who are, you know, several decades younger than me. I, of course, have work colleagues that are, you know, much younger than me. I do sense that there's less of a focus specifically on organized religion. I think mm-hmm. that there's a move towards spirituality, but I do think that, and it could just be a factor of age and experience, there's a form of grappling with spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I think it's related to not having the strongest sense of identity. I through my own personal lens, have seen that this younger generation, they've grown up being told that their voice matters, that they should be outspoken, that they should self-identify. Mm-hmm. But I think that they may be faced with a external world that seems very harsh at mm-hmm. times, and that they also sometimes lack the comfort of a barometer it's almost so much pressure to proclaim yourself as an individual, self-identify. There's so much pressure on the individual mm-hmm. that I don't think that there's as much of that community that sometimes spirituality and especially religion can provide. So I find some of my younger friends to grapple in this space. Where they don't quite know themselves. And there's a lot of rhetoric out in the world at the moment mm-hmm. about, you know, identity and pronouns and different classifications. And, you know, there's a huge focus, of course, you know, it's important on DEI, but there's so much sort of self-reflection of who am I mm-hmm. that, you know, to me, spirituality is a much broader concept. It's not just on the self. And I feel like the self-emphasis and the pressure on identifying yourself mm-hmm. has detracted a little bit from the ability to look and expand outwards. So I have one friend who is religious. He has shared with me a book on the universal Christ, mm-hmm. But he doesn't go to church. And from what I've heard, he taps into, you know, online resources, mm-hmm. You know, listening to sermons and listening to podcasts and reading books. But that is certainly very different in terms of community than what I grew up with mm-hmm. in a much more religious, you know, household where we did go to church, where there was this whole layer of education, of convening. We would have meal at the church. Mm-hmm. Then there would be, you know, family gatherings with church members. And even to the extent, you know, I mentioned that I grew up in poverty, you know, mm-hmm. the first gift I remember ever receiving on mm-hmm. Christmas was from a local church group. Mm-hmm. And it was a bag of matchbox cars that came in a brown mm-hmm. paper sack, because the church group thought that, you know, my sister and I were two boys. Mm-hmm. But it was such a vivid image in my head, and it still resonates to me today, because mm-hmm. to me it just meant that there was someone out there unrelated to us mm-hmm. who was showing us love. And so there is something very powerful, whether or not you're religious, about mm-hmm. this community building that I do think is missing. And I think, you know, back to my friend, on an individual level, he's seeking it through various online mm-hmm. resources. And, you know, I do think that there's room for that, certainly, mm-hmm. to be able to commune and talk and to listen mm-hmm. in that fashion. But, you know, I do sense like he's missing some of that, you know, in-person community, which quite frankly, we're all missing right now because yeah. of the pandemic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I don't know, like, if, you know, there are enough resources out there, if there's enough community building that's happening, if there's enough convening. And unfortunately too, I feel like there's some element of judgment that comes about, like mm-hmm. For young people, like if you believe in something organized, then you're not a critical thinker, mm. you know, and that's something too that I see, because a lot of at least religion is based upon faith, at least mm-hmm. You know, the way that I was brought up, mm-hmm. and that seems counter to, again, this movement to say to individuals, you should think for yourself, speak up for yourself, you know, self-identify. You don't hear a lot about having faith in the universe, or, you know, in some other being. And so I do worry mm-hmm. that these communities are not being built.
And to come back to you, you know, you mentioned that you were brought up because your dad was a minister, right? So when you decided, okay, for me, it's less important. So, I found my own, a different path. How did that happen? And how did your parents react to that?
So it's not easy, right, to diverge from the way that you were brought up. I did think very critically about some of the things that I had learned. And I will also share that we went through a lot of different denominations. And, you know, after mm-hmm. we immigrated to the US, we lived in the South. Mm. And there was, to me, there was some degree of hypocrisy and mm-hmm. intolerance that was built into some of my experiences mm-hmm. with organized religion. And that was probably the single catalyst that mm-hmm. that made me pull away from mm-hmm. organized religion, just seeing, you know, humans are fallible. But I saw so much of that to the extent where I realized that wasn't the community I wanted to participate in, mm-hmm. you know, and so I would say that was really that process that mm-hmm. happened. And I was an older teenager by then. And eventually when I went off to university, you know, that kind of cemented my final sort of fracture with organized religion. My parents did struggle for years afterwards. They kept saying, you know, please go back to church, etc. And we've ceased having those conversations, interestingly, as my parents have grown older. I think, you know, we haven't been terribly close as a family, but we're having more of those conversations that have personal meaning. So now we talk about things like death, dying, and not under the religious framework, but a more personal one. Because that experience, as you, you know, enter the later stages of life, unfortunately, that's a topic that is just ever present with friends and family, you know, and certainly, again, the pandemic, there's just been a lot of loss. So I find it to be more genuine to have shifted, to still have some of those tenets that I learned in organized religion, but to be able to personalize them and move away from those harmful practices that I saw. And I guess my last comment on it, the final sort of fracture for me was in organized Christianity. The way that I was taught, it is important to convey to others that they need to be saved, that they need to convert, that they may be condemned to eternal damnation. This is the way I was taught, again, in the Deep South. And those were antithetical to the way that I saw others around me. And so if you had to ask me, that was the main thing that drove me away from organized religion.
Is there something that you still teach to your daughter? Is what you learned or no, it's different. It's totally different.
It's different in that, like, I even had, you know, a lot of education around the Bible and just lots of very specific, practices. So I don't have those conversations with my children. What I do tend to have are very real conversations. They know the work that I'm in. They know that, you know, I grew up in a different way than they did. They're, I talk to them about everything from racism and hate to resiliency, to poverty, to coping. I speak to them about death, actually, health, very real topics, not in a, I hope, intimidating, overwhelming sort of way, but from the time they were very young, I would weave in stories so that they realized that their world, as they saw it, was not the entire world. And I have a quick, funny story to tell about that, though, because, you know, the lessons have changed as they've grown older. But when they were very young, we used to have what I call poverty drills. So I knew that, you know, I had developed a lot of character and resiliency because of the way I grew up. I had to learn how to figure things out and be resourceful. And all of that has helped me, you know, even in the business world, but that they would lack some of those skills. And so we would go through these poverty drills where I would simply tell them, oh, it's a really hard week. We've run out of money. And so then the little one would say, okay, can I sell some? Or, you know, and the older one would be like, okay, well, we'll make a grocery list. And I guess this week we won't. And I would say, well, what can we do without this week? And so they would make a list and, you know, those would be the groceries we would get. And it just was a way to involve their participation and for them to recognize that it's not this fluid process where just everything you want appears and, you know, there's no hardship, et cetera. And then I sort of deepened that message to say, you know, we're still very lucky because we can still buy groceries this week. Okay, maybe you can't have those cookies because that's, you know, not essential. So we talked about food, and I would say, you know, the way I grew up, and they would say, I know, you didn't have any books, you didn't have any toys. And so one day I said to them, you know, some kids don't have shoes. And my son, I can't remember what age he was like, what do you mean? You know, everybody has shoes. And I said, no, you know, there are entire countries where there are populations of kids without shoes. And he said, I don't believe you. Let's go on YouTube. I want to see these kids without shoes. It was just his way of accessing. And so I remember I went and I typed in something like, you know, kids without shoes. And the first video that came up was in India, and it was these kids playing soccer without shoes. So it was like barefoot soccer or something like that. And they look like they're having so much fun because they were. And my son was like, see, you're wrong. Like, you know, that's like a good, joyous thing. And he's like, I don't want shoes either. It is kind of funny because you set out with this like agenda, and then, you know, kids have access to so much information and their own thoughts. But I am hopeful that, you know, some degree of understanding of others and unfortunately some of the inequities in the world will be part of their experience as they continue to grow up.
I think it's good to, you know, to make our children understand, have privilege and how that is and how it works. So, thanks for sharing that. You know, you alluded already a little bit to it. You know, we are living in challenging times, and what are some of the things that you worry about at the moment?
I do worry about, so during these challenging times, you know, the effect on, you know, mental health, emotional health, just the health of people, and, you know, how we're going to move out of the pandemic. And I've been concerned with a number of things that have happened during the pandemic. You know, of course, there's a lot of focus on race, and it's, you know, sometimes when there's any sort of crisis or stress moment, you know, you hope that the ultimate outcome is that people band together, they find strength, they find new meaning. Anytime there's a fracturing of that, it's very disconcerting, because not only are you in a stressful, difficult, challenging environment, but when you start to see the fractures that occur. And, you know, I think the last year or so, we've seen both, right? We've seen like these extreme moments of coming together, you know, all around the world. And we've also seen, you know, a lot of blame, hate, divisive language, divisive actions. And so I worry about where we're going to land, how much capacity people have for understanding and compassion when their own stores are probably depleted, to be honest, when people are tired. You know, this public health crisis is one that demands that we act as a group, as a unified group. And that hasn't always happened, to, you know, very severe results. And it's not even a domestic group, it's an international, it's a global thing, you know, with migration of borders, and it's so incredibly real, people dying because of the pandemic, that it's just, I worry a lot, and I think a lot about how we are going to be as people coming out of this. What side of the pendulum will we come out on? And what will the lessons be as we look back, you know, and for different communities, different ages, different, you know, how will we all kind of resolve this? I even think about like the loss of the arts during this time I have a friend who's a musical conductor, and he said, you know, it's been a year of silence, no convening to create. You know, I have friends who are artists of various kinds, musicians, visual artists. There's been like a loss of a year of creating that I worry about. I worry about this lost generation of kids. You know, I heard a story on NPR the other day about kids not physically almost being able to go back to school because of the different social changes that they've experienced over the year, and they don't know how to interact again. And there's some fear of these like larger groups of people. So I don't know, honestly, how we'll all come out of this. And it is, you know, very much a group effort, of humanity all around the world. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard, you know, some say it'll be like the Roaring Twenties. I simply don't know. And I am concerned for, you know, my family, my friends, you know, just people.
Yeah.
I do see hope. I can't not see hope. You know, I think it's been tremendous to see how, even with the inherent difficulties, people have been finding ways to convene, finding ways to support each other. Think, you know, there's been a great deal of resiliency I've seen. I think that we're trying new things. We're stretching our bounds. We're entering into zones that aren't comfortable for us. But by and large, I see people still reaching out to each other. It looks very different, but that gives me hope. Just as an aside, I have a friend who is on death row. So it's someone I didn't know beforehand. We became pen pals, and you know, we communicated recently because for him, he's on death row. He's in a maximum security penitentiary. COVID ran through his penitentiary, and you know, I would get these frantic letters like saying how difficult it was, you know, and how scary it was in such a closed environment. And you know, they stopped all visitation rights. It became a very, very, very isolating experience for him. He couldn't see his lawyers, he couldn't see any friends or family. And he still had hope. And that hope came in the form of letters. It came in the form of being grateful that his particular cell block had not been overrun by COVID. It came in tiny doses. It came in the sun coming through his window. It came in, you know, the half hour of exercise he got in his yard. So it's been an enriching experience for me to think about the fact that, you know, as I mentioned, when my feet hit the ground in the morning, I have complete freedom to do what I can and want to do with that day, whether it's to go outside and enjoy that bit of sunshine, not through a small cell block window, but to fully be present outside, whether it's to, you know, advocate for a cause so that I'm not just sitting there saying there's nothing I can do. And so I think, you know, speaking out loud, it's that concept of freedom that leads to hope, because we're not without means, each of us as individuals. We fully have the capacity to shape our lives and the lives of others. Another friend of mine once said to me, we have more freedom than we choose to use. And sometimes during those moments when I feel dejected, when I feel like, you know, it's hard to control everything around you, I remember that there's some choice that we have and how we live our lives, the things that we choose to spend our day on. And so that's a very strong reminder that that hope exists with mm-hmm. us, you know, at that individual level. And then hopefully we can spread that through communities, through engagement, through conversation, through, you know, standing up for what we believe in, through exemplifying ourselves as, you know, showcasing what values are important. You know, I will say even in the work sphere, you know, we used to at Empowered be very agnostic. You know, we were like, we're focused on sustainability, on, you know, improving the lives of those in emerging markets. Mm-hmm. But we stayed out of discussions that appeared tangential. So, mm-hmm. You know, whether they were on, you know, diversity and inclusion, et cetera, at the beginning. And then we realized that no, everything is part and parcel of what we're trying to do, which is mm-hmm. imbue business with a different sense of responsibility mm-hmm. and value. So we started speaking out and standing up for the values that we think are important to humans in general. Mm-hmm. And it dovetailed very well with our business ethos, which is humans and, mm-hmm. you know, through products, but products that they need and that they enjoy and that they use. And it was really, you know, a great moment I felt for our employees, for our community, when we started standing up for things that we felt were important. You know, we, during the election this past year, you know, we really put a lot of emphasis on, you know, getting out to vote. We gave our employees the day off, you know, so that they can vote. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't say vote for this one or that one, but, you know, we knew that most of us, my friend in the penitentiary doesn't have the right to vote, but, you know, mm-hmm. those of us who have the right to use our freedom to speak up for our values, it's important sometimes to recognize the freedom you have mm-hmm. and to use it.
I like music a lot, and so a question that I always ask, you know, if I ask you to mention a song or a piece of music that best embodies what you are about, which song would that be? Which piece of music would that be? Oh,
such a difficult question, right? I mean, so difficult. And I love music as well. So to filter through, like, should I focus on this or this, or, you know, I best possible answer for now that I can give is not a piece of music, but a composer, and that composer is Bach. So I do play classical piano, and the reason I would say Bach is something that my piano teacher taught me when I was very young. She said in his pieces, the right hand and the left hand are equal. So in most piano pieces, the right hand carries the melody. It's what you hear, it's what you love, it's what moves you. And the left hand plays the bass. It's supportive, it's the foundation, etc. And she said, you know, again, in most composers' work, you know, the right hand is kind of characterized as feminine and the left hand masculine. I love the study of dichotomies in mythology and in language. You know, there's so many dichotomies in life. What I love about Bach is, as she said, both hands are equal. So the left hand will take over the melody. The right hand, interestingly, will provide the foundational structure in the bass. And then they switch. So there's an amazing tension and collaboration. So it's both. that exist between the two hands. They each get the ability to do like trills. So these are like ornamental sort of moves that, again, typically only the right hand gets to do, like showing off. But in Bach, both hands get to do that. Both hands get to carry so much gravity, beauty, mystery, and then they just keep switching back and forth. So in thinking about that question, I think that's the best answer that I can give, that wonderful interplay is something that I think is just amazing in life. And anytime there's a dichotomy, you know, in civilization and in nature, you know, those natural dichotomies that kind of underpin us, that tension and the resolution is where beauty and magic lie.
Right. Which concerto would you say, okay, start with that, because that's where you hear it, what I mean.
I would say start very simply with Inventions for the piano, because it's literally like very, very simple lines. And so you can hear that exchange back and forth. He has some beautiful pieces, some pieces with so much gravitas. So there you may not be able to hear it as much because you're overwhelmed with the emotion. But the Inventions are very simple and delicate. And so you can kind of hear that without, you know, that overwhelming sense.
Well, I will check that out. I'm actually at the end of our conversation almost. One last question is, if you have any message or an invitation or a question for the listeners.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I wish that it could just be a conversation that could ensue in real time, you know, because a lot of the questions you asked were so thoughtful and, you know, I'm eager to say, well, what do you think? What about you? I think that I might end with, you know, I ask this of other people sometimes. It can be in a work setting or a personal setting, but, you know, this question is sort of open-ended, but what inspired you today? Something that I like to ask, because it does tend to be a more thoughtful question than how are you, right? We've learned to very quickly answer that. I'm okay, I'm fine, etc. But what inspired you today creates a pause in the conversation, creates a thoughtfulness, and it creates a conversation that hopefully leads to something more robust, more introspective. You know, it's a starting point for a conversation. So I'd love to kind of ask your listeners to think about what inspired them today.
Great, thank you. For that and for your time. And for what you do and for who you are. My answer is very simple, and that is you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm really glad that we had this time to discuss and especially listen to you, because I know, you know, the work of that you're doing, but this shows another, you know, part of another side of you. So I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much. And good luck with everything you do.
Thank you. I too enjoyed this conversation. It felt like a conversation, and it felt very holistic, and has given me, you know, some things to think about for the rest of my day. So I appreciate it. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Same. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.